Welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review. Our several-year mission will be to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. We will be reviewing every Star Trek comic book ever published. These stories have been released by Gold Key, Marvel, DC, Malibu, Wildstorm, Tokyo Press, IDW, and others. Star Trek and all that the Star Trek universe contains is copyrighted by CBS Studios, Inc.
Hello and welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review with Donovan and Ken. Episode number 432, recorded September 8th, 2024.
And today we're finishing off the Pleroma storyline from Star Trek Ongoing. And then in Defiant, we're kicking off the second issue of the, what do they call it? The series is now called The Stars of Home. So this is the second issue of that.
Right. The Stars of Home, part two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do we know that 23 is the end of the Pleroma saga?
Oh, yeah, I guess we don't know that.
It's probably the next issue.
For sure.
I
mean, it definitely ends on a cliffhanger.
It ends on a cliffhanger. That's why I tend to think maybe we got one more issue.
All right, I'm looking at the cover for next issue. Oh, yeah, it's Pleroma Part 6. So, yeah, you're right. Pleroma's not over yet.
Well, yeah, but Pleroma itself is probably over as of the end of this issue. I know, but dig in here in a minute. And then,
storyline.
The storyline isn't quite over. It better not be. Right. Wouldn't it be something if they just left it with that?
I figured that was the cliffhanger to kick into the next storyline, but nope, you're right. They got at least one more part. And
especially
FYI
that,
today.
Especially that cover of the next issue.
Yeah.
Got to explain that.
Oh, yeah. Happy Star Trek Day, by the way.
There you go. Happy Star Trek Day.
I'm a little sad that Paramount Plus is not doing anything special for it. Last year, they had the last 2 years, they've had like a special, you know, where they actually released like an episode that kind of celebrated Star Trek and also kind of gave you hints of the future, but as of noon, nothing this year from them, they released a bunch of episodes on YouTube, but aside from that, no celebrations.
Oh, so they for free they put a lot of Star Trek episodes on YouTube.
They basically put the first episode of all the series is on YouTube. So you could watch the first episode of Lower Decks, Strange New Worlds, Picard. You know, so if you don't have your Paramount Plus, subscription, you can at least get the first episode of each of those series.
Okay, the first episode of the newer streaming shows.
Right. Might be all of them. It might be Next Generation too.
Well, that'd be cool. Deep Space Nine,
sure,
Voyager.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a temporary thing. Just long enough to get some people to reel in.
And since you, before we started recording, since you informed me that the date was chosen because it is the anniversary of the first TOS episode being aired nationally in the U.S., I think that'd be great to have that first episode shown.
Yeah, maybe I'll go watch it. Maybe I'll go watch it afterwards.
Right.
Which one was the first one they actually aired, where No Man Has Gone Before?
You know, I think really the first one was the Salt Vampire one. I think
that's right. That's right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Which is a really odd one to start with, but okay. Yeah. So where No Man Has Gone Before was that second, third. I'm not quite sure where they showed that. It's towards the beginning, but still.
Right.
Odd that wasn't the first one. Especially considering how the uniforms are a little different. And that kind of, and staff is a little different.
Right. And speaking of a little different, a few years ago, they remastered all of the TOS with new special effects, blah, 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 to get them in HD. Yeah. And then they did the same thing with Next Generation here recently.
Well,
you watched much of
it? I don't know how
the,
recent. That,
it's been within the last few years.
Yeah. Right.
But have you watched any of it? And if you have, does it kind of take you out of it like it does the original series?
Well, it doesn't take me out of it. I didn't think it ever took me out of it in the original series.
When you watch the remasters, you don't get kind of taken out of it when suddenly the Enterprise is all CG and looks awesome. You're like, wait a minute, where's the strings?
You know, the biggest thing I remember about the matting that they did with the Enterprise and the original special effects is how parts of the nacelles would kind of like bleed into the background. So as the Enterprise is going around the planet for the 15 jillionth time, and you're kind of looking at it the way they superimpose the images and stuff, sometimes the nacelles, the thin parts and things, would not be clean.
Right.
So the special effects were not good. So, I mean, they were fine for their time.
Sure.
But no, I don't miss that at all. I don't miss the crappy special effects at all.
No.
Now, what I do say is when they make big changes, not necessarily in the space things, like the effect of the agonizer in Mirror Mirror.
Right.
That was fine. It looks good and everything, but they put more into it than they needed to, I think, when they redid it.
Right. Yeah. The so same maybe that did a little bit. Adonis' hand and stuff like that. Tried to make it look cool. It still didn't, but
it's still stupid. A huge hand is clamped on our spaceship. That was so dumb.
But no, we watched the Progenitor episode from Next Generation last night on Paramount Plus, and it was the new version.
Yeah,
and so a lot of the space shots and stuff were just like, it's almost too clear. It's almost too nice. It kind of took me a little bit out of it because it's just like, it's not supposed to look that good. I mean, it always looked good, but it was also, you know, 1980s good. And now it's all like crystal clear and everything.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was, you know, the square screen. It was low resolution, you know, was it less than 480p?
Oh, yeah.
And as I recall back in the old days, I thought, oh, TNG rocks. Look how wonderful this looks. But then you take that and put it on a 4K TV, and if you don't do something to the special effects and stuff,
right? No, I remember so good having. I had an argument with my mom when I was a kid because she was a big Star Trek original series fan, and I was like a big Next Gen fan, and I'm like,
sure,
special effects are never going to get better than this. They're so great, so much better than the original series.
It's never going to get better.
Here I am 40 years later eating a big bucket of crow.
Well,
so,
and I
anyways.
Think we know enough now that things are going to continue to get better and better. Although you kind of wonder how, but it's gonna. Anyway,
all right, enough chit chat. Shall we get into the books themselves?
Yeah, let's do that. So are you doing Defiant first?
No, I'll do a second.
Okay. Okay, so I will be doing Star Trek 2022, issue number 23, Pleroma, part 5. And yes, this is part 5. Publish date, August 2024. Creative team, writer, Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. Artist, Megan Levins. Colorist, Lee Lowridge. Letterer, Clayton Cowles. Design and production, Neil Yataki. Group editor, Heather Antos. Editorial assistant, Cassandra Jones. And I must say, these ongoing ones, that's good that they're keeping a lot of the same people, you know, consistent. I mean, a lot of times you see consistency with the writers and stuff, but a lot of the people involved, including a lot of the artists, are even pretty consistent. So I like to see that. Three covers. Cover A features Huge Lore playing three-dimensional chess with the Theseus crew as chess pieces. It includes T'Lyr, Dr. Crusher, Ensign Sato, Scotty, and a falling Captain Sisko. And again, just notice that the cover here says Pleroma Part 5. Very clearly. Art by Megan Levins and colors by Lee Lowridge. Cover B features Dr. Crusher in a fetching white uniform tunic, holding a large pad in her left hand, And with her right index finger, she's pointing to a red dot labeled Pleroma on a floor-to-ceiling glass stellar cartography map, kind of like they had in the 2009 Star Trek movie. And never had an, I don't think they ever had it in TNG, but there it is. She looks like she is a little melancholy and about to cry. I'm not quite sure 100% why they put that particular look on her face, but art is by Raza. Yeah, just one word, Raza, one name. The retailer incentive cover presents a stained glass motif with Scotty's head in the center. The TOS original Enterprise is in the upper left corner. A green man's face is in the upper right corner. I assume that's one of the god people or godlike advanced creatures people. Trelane's smiling head is in the lower right corner. And finally, Apollo letting lightning fly from his fingertips is in the bottom center. Art by J.J. Lendl. Lore, descending from his Klingon bird of prey, addresses all the godlike beings of Pleroma and Captain Sisko with disdain and sarcasm. As Lore touches down on the floor of Pleroma, Charlie X gets pissed off by Lore's impertinence towards gods, and he advances with anger. Lore just motions with two fingers of his left hand and just does a Johnny Storm almost thing where he's turned into a skinless horror show while Lore says, there is no such thing as gods. Lore turns to Sisko and his mother saying he has a bomb that will destroy this and every other dimension. However, he will forego the distinct pleasure of using it if Sisko will make Lore the emissary. Sisko says he has no idea how to do that. Lore turns to the mother of Sisko, the prophet, and asks her to make him the emissary. And he will literally let everyone and her go and not destroy everything. Mother Sisko says she cannot make him prophet either. Lore states he can't directly threaten the prophets yet, but he can threaten Bajor, which the prophets seem to care about. It's big bomb time. Meanwhile, in another part of Pleroma, Sato realizes the device she brought to this powerful location caused everything to change in Pleroma for the worse. She crushes the device, but it's too late. The damage is done. Talir / Tandela explains that her orders to bring that device to this place came from an AI bent on genocide. Sato is crying and apologizes for her actions. Talir / Tandela embraces Sato and tells her, you are forgiven. Then, Talir suggests if they really want to make amends, how about they get up to that Klingon ship and do everything they can to subvert Lore's plans? Meanwhile, Crusher uses Wesley's Aegis pen to slip Scotty out of Pleroma and onto the Theseus. Crusher has taken command of the Theseus and needs Scotty's tech know-how and the whole crew to really figure out how they will outsmart Lore. On the bridge, they brainstorm how they will defeat Lore's anti-tachyon bomb. Crusher finally takes out the letter Wesley gave her. The math in the letter is beyond her, but she wants to see what Scotty and Paris can make of it. Meanwhile, Lore tries to turn Sisko against the godlike entities, including his mother, and asks him, what does Sisko really know? Sisko says he knows that Lore is a homicidal maniac, and the prophets will never give him the power of the emissary. Lore takes another tact and tries to convince Sisko he has been a hostage this whole time to the prophets. Meanwhile, on Lore's bird of prey, Talir and Sato come upon a Cardassian and Klingon crewman at workstations. One says he is barely able to maintain the shields from the shear caused by the orb, and the other is barely able to keep the flow regulators from reaching critical levels. They are both taken out by Talir and Sato, who decide to let the ship succumb to the maladies the two crewmen were trying to avert. On the bridge, the helmsman warns the Klingon captain that something has gone wrong with the flow regulators. Data's head tells them they will need to re-regulate the flow regulators by hand in engineering. It will take the captain and the other crew on the bridge to correctly deal with it. With the bridge now empty, except for Data's head, T'Lyr and Sato enter and ask Data how to shut down Lore's bomb. Data tells them they cannot disable the weapon. Since it was armed automatically when they arrived at Pleroma, it will go off. It's unavoidable. Back on the Theseus, Scotty and Tom figure out how they can use the technical design Wesley provided. The special engines of the Theseus and Tom's amazing piloting abilities might just be able to keep them ahead of the explosion when it goes off. T'Lyr, Sato, and Data's head enter through a glowy light yellow portal onto the bridge. Back in Pleroma, Sisko turns his anger to his mother, accusing her and the rest of the prophets to not give a damn about the rest of the universe. She says she does care very much and caresses the side of Sisko's head. She says, "It's time you fail." Lore is through with the chit-chat and says it's time for the grand finale. He sets off the orb-based weapon, and the godlike beings start to slowly dissolve. Sisko makes a dash for the nearby shuttlecraft and takes off. He puts the pedal to the metal and catches up with the speeding Theseus. Lore just watches the others wink out of existence and basks in his victory. He finally states, "It's done." As the Theseus speeds away, riding the explosive wave, the story ends. To be continued.
Did you like how his motivations, Lore's? I mean, why is he wanting to destroy everything? Seems a little much.
Well, yeah, he wants to destroy everything. And we don't know why he wants to destroy everything. I agree with that. And that whole thing about becoming...
the emissary.
The emissary. Becoming the emissary. It's like, what was that? A bunch of BS? Was that just him playing with the godlike beings? Because I don't think he gave a damn about being emissary of the prophets.
Right.
Or having
or
that
even
power.
What that means.
I don't think he cares about anything. Exactly. Right. What kind of power really does Sisko have? Doesn't seem like much. Anyway, it just seemed like it was a lot of time wasting in the middle of the book.
Right.
When in the end, even Data said the bomb was armed when they arrived. So it was going to go off any way you look at it.
Well, he could have gone up and stopped it. That's the way I took it, that it was primed. But and if he didn't make it back, it was going to go off no matter what.
Well, right? If anybody could. Well, did he really think he wouldn't be back? It seemed like he is more powerful than all these other beings combined.
Was he more powerful, or was he just saying just his threat was more powerful? I mean,
well, he killed.
Did he actually do anything?
Charlie X.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He did.
Charlie X got pissed and started coming at him, and he just flicked his two fingers, and, you know, Charlie X turned into a skeleton.
Yeah, that's the same looking skeleton that Mitchell Johnny turned Storm? Into.
Oh, Mitchell. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that, yes.
When,
you're right.
When,
you're right.
I guess it was Kalis that killed him, right?
You don't see it, but yeah, it must have been using the original weapon.
Right.
Which is another thing. So that scientist, that Klingon scientist comes up with the original weapon that could take out the godlike beings like Gary. And then now he comes up with a second bomb that was kind of drawn to look in a previous issue, a little bit like a warp core or something.
Right.
And then it talked about remaking everything. And then now in this issue, all it is a bomb. So I don't know. It just seems like there's some consistency that isn't 100% flowing through every issue here.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of the whole God-killing thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mainly because it's so ambiguous. I mean, what's considered a god, what's not? Because I mean, we've talked about this so many times, but
yeah,
a lot of these folks that are sitting up here on this Council of Gods thing, I'm like, eh, you're just an alien. Why are you a god and others aren't?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like the Talosians. I think they should be up there.
Ooh. Hmm. Well, I mean, if some of the other people were there, I agree with you. Because some of the other people didn't seem like gods to me.
Right.
But, or godlike powers, whatever. But, yep, agreed.
And where's Thor? He should be there. Oh, wait, wrong. I don't think they've ever had
Thor. All you're getting is Apollo. Well, in that original Taz episode, I think they actually had him say something like all the other gods had left, ascended. And he was like the last one hanging out in the material universe. So, and besides, that's Norse, not Greek.
Right.
Mythology. Yep.
But if Apollo's real, then why is Thor not real? That's all I'm saying.
Good point. Good point.
I guess I shouldn't say that. That might offend somebody who's a big follower of the Greek gods.
or the Roman versions of them.
Yeah.
There you go. And then back further, Mesopotamia, those guys had Gilgamesh and their stuff too. So they had their own set. And if you keep going back, there's all kinds.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of gods.
Yeah. Talking to people about God stuff is sometimes hard because, I mean, I know that no, to my knowledge, nobody still practices those as religions today, but, you know, who's to say they can't, and who's to say that them following those gods is any more or less
relevant
than any other religion that's still practiced today, accurate? You know? So well, I remember having this conversation when I was in Sweden, you know, talking about the Norse gods.
Mm-hmm.
And they all thought I was weird that anybody would still follow those gods. But I'm like, but, you know.
So you were speaking to locals? And
Yeah. They were like, no, those are stories. Yeah. And I'm like, well, to you.
Yeah, but back then they were their gods, right?
Yeah, right.
That's what I thought. I mean, the same way the gods were the Grecians, you know, gods in, you know, the BC times.
Right.
So.
Yeah. My thing is just when does it go from being a religion to just being stories that we used to tell?
Yeah.
You know, just the touchy subject. So maybe we should talk about
it. It is. Yeah. Because we could say something about
anything. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Okay.
So, speaking of these gods, when they were all about to get blown up with the bomb, I did like their reactions with Trelane saying, "Mumsy and Daddy, come save your precious little boy." So,
Yep, I agree.
I thought that was hilarious.
And something I really liked about that one, if I can just say real quick before you go to the next one, is just that, I mean, he went back to how he was portrayed in the original Squire of Gothos episode.
Right.
So I really enjoyed that he reverted to that. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I mean, and that's how he reverted to that at the end of that series, right? Or that episode.
That episode,
Yeah. When he was about to get in trouble for playing with his food or whatever.
Yeah, because his parents came in.
Right. So that implies that, you know, he's not the only one of that
exactly
race.
Where's the parents?
Yeah. Why are they not part of this council?
Exactly.
I still like thinking that he's some sort of a Q, but I guess not.
Well, yeah. That was revisionist, I think.
But sure.
And because of that kind of thing that went on and that kind of ambiguity that went on, I'm glad that they're back to the original idea.
Well, in the original one, wasn't it all like some sort of machines that were doing it all?
Well, that was a little confusing because Kirk shot the one mirror that supposedly there was a machine behind it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they dropped the instrumentation. But clearly the parents, well, who knows what the basis of their power was. but you didn't even see them. I mean, were they like a glowing thing, two glowing things or something?
Right.
So they appeared to have real power. So it was kind of ambiguous.
Anyway. Yeah, because they were Qs. And he was the little baby Q. He was the original baby Q.
Okay. Anyways. Okay. So go ahead. But what other diet? What other
goblin? Oh, the only other part I liked about that two-page spread was just how nonchalant the Gateway was. What's his name? Carl?
Guardian. Well, yeah. It's the Guardian of Forever who ended up getting a name and a bowler hat.
Yeah. And he's just sipping his tea because he knows that he's good.
Exactly.
He's watched Discovery. He knows he's still around in the 32nd century. He doesn't have to worry about anything.
Oh, good point. Well, I mean, okay, so that guy has been in his machine form or more machine-like form as he was. I mean, he was presented in the Taws, City on the Edge of Forever, as a machine. He wasn't
right.
He wasn't presented as like a sentient being. Although maybe he was, they definitely tried to give you the impression that he was more like, you know, the operating system or something that controlled the Gateway.
Exactly.
And that was it.
Yep.
So the whole idea that he was sentient and could speak like a normal person and not a robot or some kind of mechanism is definitely a Discovery series revisionist.
That's our word of the day.
Yeah. But I kind of like Carl.
Oh, I loved it.
I kind of like the character, but okay. So he's cool. He's been around for what, millions of years? I don't know. He's been around a long time.
Yeah. And now that we finished Discovery, I mean, spoiler if you haven't, but come to find out that the, what was the original race called? The, not the Prometheans.
Oh, them.
The progenitors? No, that's not it.
Oh, well, it's something like that. I think it's something like that. Yeah. So the people that have almost no, you know,
The ones that seeded the universe. They seeded the universe with the humanoid thing. So that's the reason why we all kind of look the same with different foreheads.
Two arms, two. Exactly. So something within a TV budget. Yes.
Right. But then they make the big revelation in that issue that or that episode that they weren't the first. They found that technology even. So there's a society that's older than them. Mm-hmm. And so that makes me think, you know, where did the Guardian or Carl come from? Is he from that far back or from that first civilization before them, the progenitors? You know, who created Carl?
Well, the civilization that created Carl, I do not know, and I will not pretend to know. But I always had the impression it was later than the progenitors, but who knows? That's just my personal.
But now that we know that there's a before the progenitors, maybe it was them.
It could be. So when we were introduced to the Guardian in Taws, it was on a planet, right? And obviously there were ruins of a civilization. And then the only thing that really was surviving functionally was the Guardian. So how long ago was the progenitors? I mean, how much before?
Yeah, 4 million years, something like that.
It just calls the question in my mind, how long can the Guardian in that mechanical form of the Gateway survive? And I guess...
Isn't he the Guardian of forever? His lifespan is in his name, forever.
You're right. you're right.
Anyways. Remind me, do they use the Guardian to get Boimler back to Strange New Worlds, or what was it that they used?
Oh, I don't. Remember? Strange New Worlds episode?
Yeah, I forgot what they used. I don't think it was the Guardian.
I don't remember them using the Guardian.
Yeah.
It was just some techno babble garbage.
Anyways. All right. We have only talked about one page so far, so let's. what else do you have for this book?
I'm going to keep on the same page, though, or the same two pages, whatever. I want to talk about the people we didn't see go poof. Of course, Sisko got away in the shuttlecraft. Of course, how long he stayed getting away, we don't know yet. But you didn't see the mother go poof.
No.
So you don't know, are the prophets powerful enough that they were able to escape this? I don't know, but they didn't show her. Another thing they didn't show was Song.
Part of the Aegis?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I forgot what her first name is, but she was an ancestor of Noonien Song. She was biologically created and became one of the Aegis people, right, with Wesley. So she was there in Pleroma in the early issues, and now nothing.
Yeah,
we haven't seen her for a while. Which brings me to the point of, she was the sole representative of the Aegis, and she wasn't an Aegis, but she was the sole representative of the Aegis. So the Aegis are still out there. Apparently, they're saying they have godlike powers, but they were not included in any of this Pleroma stuff.
Right.
So I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I think in that first issue, she says she's there as a mediator or whatever, you know, not necessarily because she's a god or whatever.
Okay.
But I might be misremembering. It's been a few months.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to point out some of the people we didn't see go bye-bye.
Right. Who else?
Well, that I think that's the only thing that comes to mind.
Oh, okay. I thought you had a list.
No, there was just a few.
Okay.
And so at the end of the issue, they show the Enterprise barely keeping ahead of the explosion wave.
The Theseus.
But then if you're... Oh, what did I say? Sorry.
Enterprise.
The Theseus. I meant Theseus. Sorry. It'd just be easier if they just called all the ships the Enterprise. Anyway. But if you're reading the book, though, turn the next page and it shows a cover from the next issue. And it says at the bottom, coming next month. And it shows the Theseus blowing to a bit. So it doesn't show that. I mean, if they're going to show that in the next issue on the cover, I'm going to go on a limb to say it happened. So even though they didn't show it in this issue. So I'm still going to say that it does happen in the next issue, as opposed to it being a bait and switch cover, which, yes, Donovan, I agree, it wouldn't be the first time they show one thing on a cover to get you to buy something. And when you look in the book, it's not in there. But I'm going to go on a limb and say it's there. And all I got to say is, if they do that, then they better have a damn good explanation. Because you know, in the end, once they get beyond this Pleroma storyline, there will be Sisko, and there will be the Theseus, and there will be most of the crew. You right. know that's going to happen.
Yep.
So, if they're going to go ahead and show the ship explode, and they're going to press somehow the magic reset button, they better do it in a much better way than they did the destruction of the original Enterprise in the Scorpius Run miniseries, Strange New Worlds, Scorpius Run miniseries. So yeah. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, remind me, that one, the Enterprise exploded, and then that one alien was able to, like, tractor beam all the pieces back together.
And
then
so,
somehow it fixed itself. Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. It was so bad.
Yeah, so all the gravitational shear forces that were going on in this during this race, the Enterprise finally succumbed to all those forces and just ruptured into little teeny tiny pieces everywhere.
Right.
All parts, nacelles, pylons, secondary hull, primary hull, pieces, little teeny tiny pieces.
And you would think little tiny people would be flying out all
exactly,
everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That was
and
a bad
in the end.
Then yeah. the next issue, they fix it pretty quick.
Well, yeah. So you're right. So they have an advanced tractor beam, basically, from some alien technology, advanced aliens, and they're able to pull the pieces back together again before everybody, or at least the bridge, people fly out of the bridge. Anyway, they're able to pull them all together, and then over the course of weeks, the whole crew working together is able to solder back together the hull. It's like, oh my god, this is so bad. Yes. Anyway, so they were able to withstand the stress of FTL speeds and everything else, and airtight. They were able to do all that. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
They better do better. They better do better with this one.
I mean, if this does blow up, then they could just always do the Cisco moving through time or whatever can somehow prevent it from happening.
Yeah.
But his mom did say that it's time for him to fail, so that would be the ultimate failure, is for his ship to explode and all his friends to die.
Right. But, you know, somehow they will bring everybody back to get life and bring the ship together again. They just better do it in a not weak way.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Now, is the Klingon ship exploding too, the Bird of Prey?
That's a great question.
Or is it just somehow igniting the bomb?
That's a great question. In my synopsis, I said it was lore that triggers the bomb, but I do not know that.
Right. But I'm just saying, we don't know the status of the ship. Did it dissolve too? I mean, he's destroying everything, right? That's his whole thing.
Well, exactly.
I want to destroy the whole universe.
Well, he says he's destroying the whole universe. The whole stinking universe. So even if your ship could get out in front of it, who cares? There's going to be no universe in the end. And what did Lore and the Klingon scientists say? Something like remaking the universe into what you wanted and you can control it?
Yeah, I think that was in the annual, right? When they were monologuing in front of the big black hole thing.
Yeah, there you go. So if he's going to do that, it's like, well, yeah, the Theseus is going to be gone. That ship is going to be gone. And then somehow Lore, either with or without Data, is somehow going to be able to use their new god powers or godlike powers to survive all that and create a whole universe.
Right.
That would be really hard, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know that they're not going. That's not going to happen, right? They're going to somehow prevent it from happening. But then there's a part of me that, you know, has watched a lot of Doctor Who, and there is an episode of Doctor Who where, you know, the Pandora box explodes and the Doctor recreates the whole universe out of memory. So if you think about it, it's like, oh, so we're not even in our real universe anymore. We're in this recreation that the Doctor came up with, because he was at the time of the Big Bang.
There you go.
So, I mean, they could go that route. Thus, that Data is able to recreate the universe exactly the way it was.
Hmm. Yeah.
I hope they don't go that route, because I hated that part of Doctor Who.
Yeah. I don't like when they go out that far.
Right. It's too big.
In storylines like that. That's too big. That's too stupid.
Right.
Let's see how far we can go
with Enterprise all. Looks different, though. You're like, oh, that's why Kirk's Enterprise looks different than Pike's Enterprise.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
That's going to be their retcon,
right?
Explanation.
There you go.
So is Data's body also on the Klingon ship?
That's another good point. I have some notes about that too.
Yeah, so they just leave it.
Right. So Sato and Talira are able to take his head back to the Theseus, so we know it's there. I mean, the head.
Right.
But the body's got to be back in the Klingon ship. Or at least that's the last place we saw.
Right.
Or was that the space station? It was the space station.
Yeah, but the space station was sucked into the black hole, right, in the annual?
Right. Right. And then the next time we see Lore, he's in this Klingon bird of prey.
Right. And Data's just a head.
Exactly. So either the space station is someplace else. Well, either it's in the space station or it's in the bird of prey.
Yeah,
the body's in the bird of prey. So even if they got away, they got his head. And then the thing I was thinking is, does that point in time, do they have the technology to recreate Data's body and put the head with the body?
Yeah, they'll just put it on Lore's body.
Well, Lore's a godlike. Okay, so obviously that means you're saying that somehow they're going to depower Lore.
Right.
And he's no longer is going to have godlike powers that can turn Charlie X into a skeleton.
Right. Well, once he's severed from the Orb of Destruction, then he won't have those powers anymore.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, is the Orb of Destruction going to destroy with this big, huge universe-destroying thing?
I thought that was what was causing it.
Well, oh, that's another interesting point. So the Orb of Destruction is partially powering it, but there's also a part where Data says it has been sucking Pleromic power ever since they got there, and it's about ready to go supercritical. Mm. So this bomb of theirs is not only using the Orb of Destruction, it's also using
Pleroma power.
Exactly, exactly. Even now, it is consuming as much Pleromic energy as possible, soon reaching critical mass. Okay, thanks, Data.
Well, we don't know what the numbers were that Wesley gave Beverly, so...
Yep.
I'm sure next issue we will find out what that was and how the Theseus doesn't explode and they're able to put everything right.
Yeah.
All thanks to Time Lord Wesley.
Exactly. Right. Another question. When you say you're destroying a universe, do you have one universe within an infinite number of parallel dimensions? Or when you say you're destroying the universe, are you destroying all parallel dimensions also?
Right. Good question.
Okay. Because I don't know. I'm a little confused.
I was thinking the same thing. I mean, once you start introducing parallel universes and alternate timelines, then someone saying, I'm going to destroy the universe doesn't sound that bad anymore. Well, there's always like a million other universes where everybody's just fine.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, are we going to end up seeing a Rick and Morty thing where now the story's going to go on with a different dimension that was really, really close to ours?
Exactly.
Don't worry about it. It's so close, it's not worth splitting hairs over.
So Sato's finally feeling bad for her behavior over the last few issues.
Yeah.
I like that. I mean, it always seemed kind of out of the blue that she acted like that to begin with, but
yeah.
I'm glad that that's kind of going to be over, I guess.
Yeah, but it's also, I agree, because I was really getting sick of her. So she finally made the last transgression. She's betrayed Captain Sisko again. And now we don't need her to be a really angry, pissed off, irrational person.
Right.
And so now she can go back to the original nice Sato that we were introduced when we first started reading this ongoing series.
Right.
So hopefully. I'm glad that she's back to normal. But I got to say, it is even more manipulative that she did go so irrationally angry and nasty.
Yeah, she went hard to the dark side.
Yes. Yes, she did. Yep. She did an Anakin, but came back. Okay. So that Klingon that's sitting in the captain's chair, the Khan?
The one with the monocle? The Borg
monocle?
Yeah.
Ooh, let's talk about the Borg next. So when I first see him there, it's like, wait a minute, that's not the Kalis clone, right? I don't think it's the Kalis clone. But no, the first thing I thought when I saw it, I was thinking, oh, the Kalis clone, they brought him back. And it's like, oh, probably not.
Yeah.
It's just another Klingon. Okay, so they've got...
But he has Borg pieces, though, too. I mean, he has a Borg arm, and I think that's a Borg monocle.
But look at them. They do not look like they're full Borg.
No, they're not full Borg, but...
But they looked more like full Borg in previous... Was it the previous issue?
It was the annual, yeah.
Okay, maybe it was the annual. Okay, so they were looking like Borg.
Right.
Where in this issue, they kind of dialed back the Borg thing, and now they kind of look like they've got maybe Borg enhancements, but they're not... necessarily gone full Borg.
I agree.
Because look at how they talk to each other.
Right.
They talk to each other more like a normal Klingon, not a Borgified something or other.
Which is how Lore's Borg acted with each other.
No, that's true. After they were released.
Yeah.
Right. They were released from the collective.
Right.
Okay. So they could be just like that, or they could just be, you know, using Borg tech to enhance them without necessarily flooding their bloodstreams with nanites and all that kind of stuff. It could be all external enhancements.
Right.
But I don't know whether the difference makes any difference.
Yeah. hopefully that's another thing they explain next issue, but I kind of feel like they're not going to.
No, I don't think they're going
to. I think they're just like, that looks cool to have a Borgie looking guy there.
There you go. Okay, the last thing I want to say about this issue is when I was first reading it, it was like, okay, so this is kind of predictable, and Laura blows up everything. Okay, fine. And even looking at the cover from next issue, the Theseus blows up. Okay, fine. But then after I did the synopsis, and then I kept on going over it a bit, and then looked for comments and things, I started to like this issue more and more. I mean, there's definitely things in here that are probably not ideal, but there's still a lot going on here. And I don't like the issue.
Yeah, more than
a lot of previous ones.
Yeah. It's really ramping up the ending, so it really feels like they know where we're going and we're just heading straight there. So it felt a little abridged at parts where it's just like we're just kind of being told what's going on and just go for the ride.
There you go.
But yeah, no, I liked it. And I really like that shot of Lore descending from the bird of prey. That was a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
Full page, just Lore in the foreground and the bird of prey up in the skies.
Right.
Really
descending
nice.
From the heavens.
Yeah. I liked it.
Cool.
All right, that was my last comment. Anything else?
Nope.
All right. Then we'll move on to Defiant, issue number 18. This came out in August of 2024. Stars of Home number 2, written by Christopher Cantwell, artist by Angel Unzeta, colorist by Marissa Louise, letterer Clayton Cowles, production and design Neil Utaki, group editor Heather Antos, editorial assistant Cassandra Jones. So there's three covers at the back of the book. The main cover is by Angel Unzeta, and it shows Worf standing on a cliff pointing out to somewhere, and then a bunch of like farmers and stuff at the bottom looking at where he's pointing. They even have the pitchfork and stuff in classic monster hunting fashion. Cover B is by Elizabeth Beals, and it shows Sela, I kind of setting in a seductive pose kind of stuff, looking straight at the reader, and maybe like lightning or something kind of crackling around her. I can't really tell what that is. And then the incentive cover is by Declan Shalvey, and it shows Miles O'Brien, and then behind him we see the Defiant. So for a book called Defiant, it's nice to see the Defiant on at least one of these covers. So the story starts with the imprisoned and in solitary confinement Spock, and he is suddenly visited by Sela. Sela tells him that he is going to go into general population and that he needs to familiarize himself with the inmates in order to get some information about what her father has planned. Us, the reader, are thinking that maybe she's not fully bad anymore, but the jury is still out. Meanwhile, Worf, Ro, and B'Elanna have ditched their Romulan disguises and reverted back to their true faces. They do have a little comment about how the surgeon that did it wasn't very nice and that they kind of miss Namara. They're on the planet Antara, and they're preparing for the oncoming Romulan forces. They have very few armaments, but the inhabitants there are prepared to help fight with them, though they are mostly just simple farmers. They do point out that they once survived a Borg attack, and then they show Worf that they have two antique Hirogen ships. This is not very much, but perhaps it'll help in the attack. Elsewhere, Spock does meet with some Romulan prisoners. They correctly deduce that he is a spy, which Spock does not refute, and he says perhaps he's a spy on their side. Sela meets with her father about his orders to destroy Worf and his crew. She tries to get him to reconsider, but he does not, and she does not overplay her hand. So sounds like she's going to go with it, even though maybe she's not quite evil anymore. throughout the book, we had a lot of little scenes of what O'Brien's been doing. So he does leave Keiko and Earth in order to search for the Defiant. He follows the transponder information that he got last issue, and he does eventually find the ship. When he gets there, he scans it and finds out that it's filled with Kinzanti pirates. He beams over and he plays out a scene from Die Hard by crawling through the air vents until he finds a few of the cat people trying to access the computer with command codes. He then sneezes because he has a cat allergy, and then he pops out of the air vent in time to complete the command override himself, and now he orders the ship to fill with helium. Since the Kinzanti are, I guess, allergic to helium, or they just don't like squeaky voices, they beam back to their ship. Meanwhile, O'Brien orders a holo navigator to pop up and then orders her to start flying the ship because they have some friends to save. To be continued.
How nice to see a Delton again. So is that a Delton? Holo?
It does kind of look Helmsman? Like one. Right.
Like Leah? Lilia or whatever?
In the motion picture? Right. Perhaps it's a Delton or just a bald lady.
Yeah, it could just be a bald lady, but she's pretty hot looking bald lady. And that tells me Delton.
Well, she's a hologram, so she won't have the Delton pheromones that drive men.
Exactly. Drive men wild. Like Decker. There you go.
It is funny, in that novel, they bring that up quite a few times, that she's able to repress her pheromones. Otherwise, all the men would be all over her all the time.
Yeah,
That's such a weird novel.
It is a weird novel. There's so many interesting little details, like, huh? Well, I can see why you didn't put that in the script.
Right, or it was in the script, and they didn't make it past the cutting room.
Right, exactly.
Anyways, but yeah, so where did these holo emitters come from? Because he's getting the program from the shuttle, but that doesn't mean there's holo emitters on the bridge at all time now, or is there now?
Excellent question, because this was, in a way, it was kind of reminding me of Captain Rios.
100%, yeah.
Which, of course, that was further in the future, though.
Exactly.
So is this like somewhere between the Holo Doctor of Voyager and the Rios version, where the Holo crew looked like real people? They're not some kind of glowy thing.
Right. Yeah, I don't know why she's glowy here. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And Prodigy, they must have had holo emitters all over the place, because in Prodigy, hologram. They had holograms running all around. Well, not only that, but also, you know, when the kids leave the ship and then they leave holographic duplicates of themselves, those holograms had free reign over the ship.
Oh, that one episode?
Right. And it was quite a few episodes, but yeah.
So that was on Voyager?
No, it was on Prodigy.
No, the Voyager.
Oh, yeah, Voyager A. Yeah, you're right, Voyager A.
So it's the new Voyager, and I could see by that point in time, after all the value that the Doctor had with his portable emitter thing, holo emitter thing, that if you were building another Voyager, might you build in holo projectors all over the ship? Maybe. But this is the Defiant.
It's like a lot of work. Yeah. Definitely shouldn't be on the Defiant.
Yeah, and the Defiant's an older ship. So right. I agree with your question.
I mean, I guess the Defiant did have that hologram technology one time, but that hologram couldn't touch stuff and fly the ship. Remember when there was like one episode where Sisko talked to his boss, mentor, that turned into a Maquis or whatever?
Oh, I was now the original first episode of no, it's not. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there were definitely examples where holograms were used for communication purposes.
Right.
You know, he was on the bridge of the Defiant, I guess, and he was talking to somebody, and the guy looked like he was there.
Right, exactly. Just standing there next to him. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think they only used it like once or twice. It wasn't all that common.
Right. Well, how about this? If you have a holo helmsman, all you really need to do is have one projector on the bridge.
And maybe that's why she's glowing.
Exactly. And that person's not going to go anywhere else. The specific, it's like the doctor in sick bay. You've got a special purpose hollow helmsman that is only on the bridge.
Right. And what if she's not really there? It's just she, because it never actually shows her touching the keyboard. It just kind of looks like her hands are above. So maybe the computer's just flying it and she's just like an animatronic just going through the motions to look like she's controlling something to give Miles someone to talk to. I don't know.
I don't know either. But okay. So the original Enterprise, or no, the refit Enterprise in Star Trek III, it required Scotty and a bunch of janky automations that Scotty put in place to be able to, did they have five people, something like
right,
that
right.
on the Enterprise. And they were able to crippled, not the best in the world, but they were able to joyride in the Enterprise.
Yeah, they held their own.
Exactly. Now in this one, we've got the Defiant, which is only supposed to have like 50 people or so as crew or less or something like that, as opposed to hundreds with like the Enterprise. And it is more advanced time period and things like that. So you would think you'd be able to do more things automatically. But now we're down. Miles is able to effectively navigate the ship with one human and one automation.
Yeah.
So they better not point out that seems
stuff. I don't want to see a bunch of quantum torpedoes being shot and things like that. Who's loading those?
Flying.
Who's loading those torpedoes?
Exactly right. Anyway, I just thought there wasn't a lot of people involved. Right. So obviously a few things briefly. So apparently the Romulans did not think that the Defiant was old enough a ship that it had no value to take back with them. Taken in tow.
We still don't know how she got how they got captured, right? I mean, could
how they got captured?
Well, they got. So that last storyline, did it end with them actually being like tractor beamed, or I'm trying to remember.
So
after the bug thing,
so Sela's father, who's trying to take over the Romulan Empire, came up in his Deridex, nose to nose with the Defiant, and Sela basically turned gave him up.
Yeah.
So that's the last time we saw the Defiant. And then the next thing we know, Worf and the gals are on some Romulan ship. Exactly. Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right. So, yeah, why did they just leave it there? Unless Sela put it back there behind her dad's back.
Yeah.
I mean, because it definitely seems like she's on the right side now.
Something I do like about Sela is she's another one of those characters that is bad, is good, is bad. And so, you know, she kind of flicks back and forth a little bit. But I think in the end, she's going to do the right thing. But she was raised, you know, to be Tal Shiar and to be a Romulan. So, you know, she still may have some desires for power and stuff. I mean, wasn't there a part in this book where she says something about when she's Praetor or something?
Right. Yep. Nope. She says she's going to be Praetor.
So, you know, that doesn't make it sound like she is planning on, you know, going off with the rest of the crew and having a great time.
Right.
It sounds like she's got some other plans.
Maybe she just doesn't want to see him dead, but that doesn't necessarily mean she wants to see him succeed either.
Right. So that's what's interesting about her. We don't know what she's going to do next, for sure. I think.
No, you're right.
So who is feeding Brian? Was Julian feeding Brian all this info about that Romulan broadcast?
Yeah, I thought that I thought he gave it to him in the last issue. It was the last issue.
I think there were.
There was two messages. One was from O'Brien, and the other one he had to put in a command code in order to open. And that was the one that had the.
That had the Romulan
message
transmission.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
I thought they were both from O'Brien, but maybe one was from the Defiant itself. Who knows?
Well, O'Brien was definitely sent a transmission that got him onto all this, because otherwise he wouldn't have known.
Right.
So.
And O'Brien, because But they were both on that mission to get in the annual, right? Was Bashir there? Yeah. It was Geordi. It was Geordi and Geordi and Miles. That's right.
Right. Miles getting this much love from both franchises is pretty cool. But I'm just wondering if Julian's going to show up.
I hope so. And I hope Geordi shows back up too.
Yeah. No, that would be good.
It would be cool if they could get Geordi and Spock together and then the series end with them like, oh, we're going to go work on a new jellyfish design ship or something like that.
Right.
And set up that whole storyline.
Yep.
So I have a question. I'm not fluent in Romulan, but what is Yut and Mok?
I have no idea. What page are you referring to? At least they're not saying Yug Nug.
I don't know what page it is. It's when Sela's dad's telling the Romulan no survivors.
The Romulan Hulk guy?
Yeah, the really muscular dude.
Right.
Right, but then that guy has a conversation with another monocle thing. Man, I really like the monocle stuff. But it's like four panels, and it's the commander saying Yut, and then the second panel is the monocle guy saying Mok.
Mocked.
And then Yut again, and then Mok again. So what is that?
Well, okay. There's two guys that look almost the same, like they're almost twins. One, they both have the same kind of monocle eyepiece on. One has facial hair. The other guy doesn't have facial hair.
No, you're saying those are two different people?
They're two different people. The one guy is holding a rifle. The other guy is holding a knife. One guy has a beard and a mustache. The other guy does not.
All right, so commander says Yut to two different people that are twins.
I think they look similar. I mean, quite frankly, the first guy looks like Spock.
It does.
So Spock, he's a very Spocky looking Romulan. And I'm guessing that these two guys are brothers or something. And they're like the big Romulan Hulk commander guys, you know, assassins or something.
They're going to go to the planet to kill Worf when all they have to do is shoot it from orbit.
Okay, can we talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay. So Worf and the gals are in a perfectly good ship.
Mm-hmm.
And they could go running. And they got the Praetor and the guy who's in charge.
The head of the Tal Shiar,
Exactly, right. And so at one point in the previous issue, that was the thing, right? And the Praetor, or Sela's father, in that broadcast says something about how they're going to go to Antaran. And I thought the main point of that was to get those two guys, the leaders of the Romulan Empire, who the father is now taking over.
Right.
I thought that was the point of it. Now, in this issue, Worf and company has gone all Magnificent Seven, or Seven Samurai, or whatever you want to call it, where they're going to be using these simple peasants in a ground-based defense against the oncoming Romulan horde. And now the father says something about, he seems to be more preoccupied with the planet, Antares, or whatever the name of the planet is. To me. So it's like, wait a minute. Did we just do a total shift here? I mean, are we going to see that Praetor and the other guy anymore? Or now it's just going to be a Magnificent Seven thing?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. And it bothers me because they are on a perfectly good shuttle, like you said. They're only going to Antari because Sela's dad told them to kidnap these two people and then meet me at Antari. But then they saw the broadcast that says, we're going to Antari to kill the kidnappers. Then if I'm Worf, I wouldn't go to Antari. It's just like, I'm going somewhere else.
Exactly. And I'm going there as fast as I can.
Right. Not stick around and train the farmers.
Yeah, where we know the bad guys are coming.
Right.
Now, mind you, he could also think, well, they're going to catch up to us eventually. and might as well make a stand here, but they never say it. They never talk about that at all.
But they have the two heads of the Romulan Empire. All they got to do is to go talk to them. Okay, hey, we were under orders from Sela's dad. He's obviously doing some sort of coup. We're going to take you back to Romulus and you let us go, you know. we were duped.
Or you let Spock go.
Let's go back.
Yeah. But I have the impression that what's his name, the father, already has taken control. But I don't know.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But we know it's short-lived because he's not the praetor at the beginning of Nemesis.
Yeah, exactly. We know he is not going to succeed. And we also know that probably behind him is really going to be Shinzon.
Right. Yeah.
Odds are Shinzon is pulling this guy's strings.
We've had Shinzon in one page of this series, and I keep waiting every issue, every month. Is this where he comes back? No, it's not.
Right.
So, anyways.
Okay, so we'll find out.
Hopefully.
Now we're here with a Magnificent Seven kind of thing. Seven samurai, whatever.
Three amigos.
Three amigos. Exactly, three amigos. Good point. Three amigos. But now we start finding out that these simple Antaran farmers, simple farm people that kind of look like Cardassian lights when you look at their faces, find out they are able to withstand a Borg invasion.
Which we did, they did say that in the last issue.
I know.
And they said it was in the 19th century, which, again, I still have a problem with why the Borg would show up 100 years or more, attack this one planet, and then go back to the Delta Quadrant.
Exactly. Their thing is they normally assimilate cultures. Right. They don't show up, attack, and go, we change our mind.
Right.
So,
except for Guinan's people. I mean, they did do that then. She got attacked by the Borg, and then that would have been... And then they headed to Earth and got there right when the Enterprise B was being launched.
Well, I know, but I thought they were leaving their star system to get away from the Borg.
Yeah, but I'm
saying they took over the Borg. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just saying time frame wise, that would be about 100 years before this story.
Okay.
So maybe this is near wherever Guinan's from?
That's a leap, but maybe. I don't know. That's interesting you brought that in. My main point is they were able to survive that with the Borg. Okay. Pretty impressive. How'd you do it? And then now we also see that a Hirogen hunting party with at least two decent-sized ships had come to the planet. And they didn't take off again. So somehow the Antarans...
killed them off?
Killed them. The Hirogens. And as we know, the Hirogen hunters are pretty formidable.
Yeah, those are the guys that look like Predators, right? With the
kind of they're basically Star Trek's predators, right?
Yeah,
because they go hunting other species for fun, and they're pretty.
They got that weird mouth thing too. I mean, not quite mandibles, but
right,
little predatory.
Okay, so these simple farmers were able to reject two formidable sets of attacks. How could they do that? The first thing I'm thinking is, maybe these guys aren't full-on Organians, but they got something else going on here. They are not just what they appear to be. There's more to them than that. Which is going to come in handy because the idea of Worf and ladies being able to work with these people and a few old Hirogen ships and maybe their Romulan shuttle and do anything against these other guys incoming, this Hulk Romulan guy.
Right.
There's got to be something else there helping out. These Antarans actually having some more powers than meet the eye would be very handy. And of course, it's just going to be very handy that when Miles shows up with a Defiant,
right?
That should be very handy.
Yeah, he's going to show up cloaked and be able to do all this crazy stuff and save the day.
Yeah.
Even though it's just him by himself.
Right. Or he shows up after the battle's over and he's able to give the ship back to Worf. I don't know.
Right. But I mean, it just drives home that there's no need for, because what Worf's doing, he's like building up walls out of rock, and they have guns that shoot rock, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like, when the Romulans show up, they're not going to come out of orbit. They're just going to shoot you from space.
From orbit.
The whole thing's going to be over. Well, you know, they're not coming down to the planet to get hit with a rock. Or they shouldn't. I bet they shouldn't.
I bet they do. I agree with you.
All they have to do is fly to the planet, lock onto the Klingon life signs, beam it into space.
Exactly.
And they've succeeded.
Or maybe not into space, but just grab them.
Yeah. Their orders were to kill them. That would kill them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. He did say no survivors. Good point.
Can you beam into space? I guess so.
I think you can. I don't. They don't do it because they're ethical. Well, okay, the Federation doesn't do it, but I mean, well, why wouldn't you be able to?
I've just you've sometimes made an argument that they use materials that are on the planet to reconstitute your body there instead of transmitting your actual particles from place to place.
No, I say it's matter energy conversion. All 100% matter energy conversion. So you're converting matter into energy, and then on the other side, energy into matter. That's what I'm saying.
But is it the same energy?
I guess so. Okay. I mean, you're transmitting it, right?
Right.
The whole idea that you could reassemble something in a remote location without some kind of a booth or some kind of device makes no sense to me at all. So what they do in Stargate, there's transporter technology, but you see that in the target location, these rings appear.
Right.
And then that reconstitutes people that have been transmitted. Now, how those rings got there, I'm not 100% sure, but it makes a little more sense than what Star Trek does.
Yeah. No, I get you. So anyways, I had another comment, but I forgot what it was now. Oh, yeah.
The Kzinti.
Yeah. So what did you want to say about him?
Talk about that. Oh, I'm just happy to see him.
Lower Decks talks about him a lot, and they were in the animated series. Is this the first time we've seen him outside of that?
I think so. So the Kzinti were actually created by Larry Niven in some short stories he wrote.
Right.
So how they ended up in Star Trek and how they ended up getting adapted into Star Trek. I think the first time we saw the Kzinti was in the animated series.
Yeah.
Same. So exactly how the Kzinti got into that episode, I don't know. I probably should have looked it up further. I don't think Larry Niven wrote that episode of the anime series. I don't think he did, but somehow he's in there. What the slaver weapon was the name of the.
But he's written other stories with the Kzinti that are outside of Star Trek.
Completely outside of Star Trek. Yeah. Yeah. Larry Niven has written a lot of cool stuff, but to the best of my knowledge, no Star Trek stuff. But for whatever reason, these characters, this alien race, no problem. Use them in Star Trek. I thought was always kind of interesting, but yeah, so it's interesting they had him in here, and it's also interesting at first I thought it was kind of weak when O'Brien is in the ducks and he sneezes and it's like, oh my god, that is so typical. That's been done like a thousand times. And then when he comes down doing the, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger quips as he takes out the three Kzinti, he says, sorry, but I'm allergic to cats. Oh, that's good. I like that.
Oh, you like that part.
I like that. So it was a setup. It was a setup for a joke.
Oh, okay. I didn't like that part either.
Okay. Well, you didn't like any of it. I didn't like the first part of it until I realized it was a setup for that joke. Then it was like, okay, fine.
And so the whole helium thing, what was up with that? Because I mean, is that from the animated series? Say, maybe. I don't know.
I don't remember that from that at all. But maybe it was. But he says, Disney say something about why he asked the computer to do that instead of like normal anesthesine gas?
Yeah, he says they can't process it or something like that.
Okay.
He has a BS reason.
Okay. I've never heard of that before. And why would he do that rather than just doing anesthesine gas, which has been...
I guess he doesn't want to knock himself out. Because he can talk in a squeaky voice for a bit, but...
That's fine.
If it was the gas, he'd be out cold.
Okay. Yeah. Good points.
Just thought that was weird. But yeah, no, I was glad to see him just because it's a species that's tied in with Star Trek that you don't see very often.
Right.
Because they're not quite the same cat species as Marais.
Right.
But they are another cat species.
Yes. Actually, in the animated series episode, Sulu says something about there being an Earth-Kazin war. Kazinti war that happened in the past.
Oh, really?
Yeah, what was it? In the Slaver Weapon, Hikaru Sulu simply states that the last war between Kazinti and humans was 200 years ago.
Well, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
200 years, so, that'd be like now.
Yeah. So that would have been pretty early in the humans being out beyond the solar system. Anyway, moving on. Cardassians. Anyways. So these Antarans look a little bit like Cardassians. What do you think?
They look a lot like Cardassians, just without the neck ridges.
Right. So is that on purpose or is it just random?
I think it's just because we're all part of the same progenitor pool base that just just happen to look alike. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I do like their heads though. Looks like snakes wrapped around their eyes.
Right. So the Cardassians have more ridges. They got ridges like going up along the upper left and right edges of their head, and of course they got more shit on their chin and their necks. But look at their head. I mean, it's kind of like a spoon without a handle. So they kind of, because it's got the loop, right?
Yeah, but it looks more like almost like horns or something. I mean, they're not poking out like horns, like horns that are underneath your skin.
Okay.
It's a lot bigger than a spoon.
But it's a... Oh, it almost comes to a point. So it's like an oval.
Right.
It's like an oval, but there's a little gap at the very top. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So it still looks like a spoon without a handle to me. But it's just so close. I just wondered.
You think it's gonna factor into it?
I don't know. When you read that Stitch in Time that talks about Garak's background, you will find out that the Cardassians came from an earlier race.
Oh, that really?
We're not warlike, and we're almost like American Indians, you know, very in touch with nature and not aggressive and blah, 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 blah. I just wonder if that's tied in at all with these guys. Probably not, but.
Well, that would be kind of a cool tie in.
It's a bit of a stretch that most people wouldn't know about, so I kind of tend to think not, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that'd be cool if they did do that.
Yeah, that's all I got to say about this issue.
Yeah, I don't have anything else either. Just about the covers for both this issue and last issue, I really like that Crusher issue cover from the first from the Star Trek 23. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the... I mean, it looks just like her. I mean,
that's one of the
more beautiful pictures I've ever seen of her. And and she's in that uniform, which we've never seen her wear, but it looks beautiful. It's great. I love that.
Yeah, it's very photorealistic. So they did a lot of good work on that.
Yeah. And then this cover has that Sela one, which it's not the same pose and it's not in the same style, but
no, not at all.
Again, it's just like a whole page of just one character. It just happens to be the token blonde girl. But it's just weird because this one, it looks like they're trying to do like a seductive type picture, whereas the Crusher right. one, it was just she's doing her work, you know, she's yeah. being the doctor, doing her thing, yeah. and she's still, and you know, still a beautiful picture. And then here it's like you're trying to be sexy, and I don't know, doesn't quite fit.
No, there's something. The Crusher one's really nice, and the thing that doesn't fit about it is she looks very dour. So she looks beautiful and everything, but she's like, I don't know, like Mona Lisa. Only in Mona Lisa, you're not quite, she's kind of in between, so you're not quite sure what's going on in her head.
I mean, again, where, she's about to watch Pleroma to be destroyed. She has a reason to be sad.
Well, okay, fine. But my point is, she's still beautiful. And she looks great, but she looks very unhappy.
She does, yeah.
Where usually when you see women depicted, very beautiful women depicted, they're usually more on the smiley side.
Right.
Now, whereas I do agree with you, the Sela drawing, that's by Elizabeth Beals, so it's a lady. But there is a kind of sexy thing going on there. I mean, why is her right leg being lifted up like that?
Right, right. Yeah, and it's it's a shot, you know, it's the POVs from lower, so she, you know, mm-hmm. we're looking past her legs to get to her face. And
yep, looking up at her.
Yeah. Looks yeah, like I don't know. It just didn't fit Sela. She's not a seductive type character.
Oh, she could be. We just haven't seen her do that.
Right. No,
I don't remember ever seeing her doing that.
No, she's a kick butt,
right?
Romulan warrior.
Right, there you go. There you go. But she's also a spy,
right?
So I'm sure that's part of her bag of tricks to be seductive. That is,
and that's what this is depicting. Something that we're not going to see in this book.
No, we're not going to see that in this book. No.
All right.
I do like both series where they're going. I look forward to the next issues, which we will not be discussing next time.
Nope. We got to wait for the books to come out. So that's the downside of being all caught up is that we don't have more Trek books to read.
Right. So what are we going to do about that?
Well, next week we're going to dust off the old Star Trek Comic Book Presents again.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple times ago we did a Predator versus Wolverine story.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time of recording, Romulus is in the theater, so we thought an aliens versus somebody would be kind of interesting, so we're mm-hmm. doing aliens versus Superman.
Exactly. I mean, there is a Batman series too, but no, we're doing Superman.
Yeah, we're doing the Superman one, which I remember loving back in the 90s when I read it, so I'm looking forward to reading it again.
And totally random, YouTube throws at me, just because I was probably watching some Alien Romulus things. And so it throws at me a synopsis and throwing in a few comments, who does that kind of thing, for Superman versus Aliens. And it's like, okay, I'll look at this. I think the whole idea of Superman versus Aliens is weak, because again, as usual, Superman is too powerful. He can easily pop the heads of these aliens. There's no threat here at all. However, that's what I went into it expecting. And they did a good job of writing the book.
Yeah.
Or the miniseries. The three-issue miniseries.
Right. Yeah. I look forward to rereading it. And then I'm going to watch that video of that you saw from Alien Theory, which I really like his stuff. So, I'll get his opinion after I reform mine from rereading it. But I remember when that came out, man, I loved it because it's my two favorite franchises, you know, Superman and Aliens together. Mm-hmm. What is there not to like?
Right. Okay. So we'll do it next time. And we got plenty to say.
Right, right. And then maybe we should, I don't know, maybe pump the brakes on the non-Star Trek stuff for a bit. I don't know.
Well, especially
it feels weird that we're doing more non-Star Trek than we do Star Trek now.
True, but we're into the presents thing, so we're very into doing new things. However, we do have a new source of short stories that you knew about, but I didn't know about, that we may be doing coming up here.
Yeah, that'll be something different, but at least in the same Star Trek vein. So be on the lookout for that.
Sounds great. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the review.
Later.
Thank you for listening to Star Trek Comic Book Review. All Star Trek stories and characters are copyrighted CBS Studios Incorporated. All music, stories, and characters discussed are for entertainment purposes only. You can email us at startcomicbookreview@gmail.com. Visit us at our website, www.stcomicbookreview.com. Subscribe to us via iTunes or friend us on Facebook at First Name ST Comic, Second Name Book Review. See you next time on Star Trek Comic Book Review.
Let's get the hell out of here.